It's After 6, Todd Feinberg with you, and joining us, as usual, Michael Leibowitz, calling from the big house. You'll hear the beeps in the background, you'll hear the noise from time to time, and other sounds of prison, where Michael has lived for 22 years in the state of Connecticut. We're going to talk about integrity today, personal integrity and compromising values. Michael, welcome back to WTIC.
Thanks, Todd. As always, it's good to be here.
All right, so what's on your mind about integrity?
Well, I want to start with compromise. Compromise is always, you know, often held out as if it's the pinnacle of virtue. And I don't believe that is always the case or even usually the case.
You don't think it's good to compromise?
Well, it depends on what you're compromising about, ultimately. But when it's used in politics, I think for people on our side, and by that I mean people for liberty, people for small government, I think it's actually detrimental. And, you know, I'll give you a couple examples. Suppose I'm the small government guy and you're the big government guy. I say I don't want any taxes. You say you want a 10% increase in taxes. Let's compromise. Government increases. Right? Any compromise I make at that point, whether it be 1% or 9% increase, leads to an increase in government.
Well, let's just give a little more subtext to that point, because I think it's a great point.
Okay.
Let's say you think the country's been run in the wrong direction for the past 70 years or so. And throughout that time, taxes have increased dramatically. And no matter how much we dramatically increase the taxes, the plunderers overspend, so we're always running up debt, whether it's on the federal level, whether it's in the state of Connecticut. Financial disaster is what government has delivered with the idea of compromise. So after all this 70 years, 80 years, whatever it is of compromise, you can draw your line in the sand wherever it is in history. But the net result is absolute plunder, and they need to dramatically cut spending. So why would you even be talking about an increase in taxes?
Yeah, and the problem ultimately is at the beginning, when they were first negotiating, somebody conceded that the government had the right to tax, the right to take money by force. And the problem is once you cede that point, once you give up the principle that my money is an inalienable right for me to keep, there's no point at which to draw the line. There's no point at which to stop. Similarly, suppose I want drugs all to be legal, unregulated. And you say, well, let's just have a few laws. Again, any compromise I make leads to an increase in government. And I think that we could go through an enmity of issues and see that that's always the case. And we're always called upon to compromise. Not me, literally, because I'm not in office, but I think you know what I mean. But in every time, it's never enough. It always increases, because once you give up the principle that government's point is or purpose is to defend individual rights, you've given up the whole game.
Now, Michael, I have to confess to having been resistant and still feeling a touch of resistance to the idea of saying that government never has the right to tax. However, having watched the relentless plundering of the great wealth of the country, and I think the state of Connecticut is a unique example, one of the wealthiest, or some people say the richest state in the country, in terms of the amount of money in the pockets of the people in the state, which is where it belongs. The response of the government has been to spend relentlessly and irresponsibly and indefinitely. Like, what we can see right now is there is no ability on the part of the people who run the state to stop growing spending. Forget about turning it around, which we desperately need. And that has me reconsidering the idea that government even should be granted a right to tax, that we should say inherently that government can only take the money that we offer it and nothing more. But I have to say that people are going to listen to us and think we're crazed.
Well, people thought Thomas Jefferson was crazy, too, so we're in good company.
They did? Who thought that?
I don't know. It's just something people say, Todd. I don't know if it's meant to be taken literally.
No, but you've got to establish, work through the point a little more. Doesn't government, because remember, we had a more stripped down government originally, and
I don't know how true that is, Todd. Hold on. I know people often say that. But what you had was more power in state governments. We didn't have a powerful federal government. That doesn't mean that the state governments were without power.
No, but it does mean that the federal government was designed in such a way to have extremely limited power to make sure it wouldn't run out of control. So the founders were particularly suspicious of a federal government because they saw that, I think, as a projection of King George off in England. That would be the same thing as having a big government in Philadelphia or Washington or wherever you placed it, and that the best government was close to home. So if states wanted to adopt their own system where they could get robbed, like the state of Connecticut, where the people have been robbed blind and the viability of the state has been severely compromised, well, that's up to the state to resolve. But the federal government should never be the one that's running out of control without any restrictions.
Well, I agree that the federal government shouldn't be running amok without any restrictions. However, I will say that I don't think that 50 tyrannies is better than one.
Well, I would say 50 small ones is better than one huge one that covers the domain that the 50 cover, because...
Either way, tyranny is bad. And we're right now, I mean, what I really wanted to focus on was on the state of Connecticut, because I think the state's in big trouble.
Okay, explain. And
why do I think the state's in big trouble?
I don't know.
Because they've got a bunch of unfunded pension liabilities that they need to pay or think they need to pay, and no way to pay them.
Yes.
They keep raising taxes, they're calling for tolls, and it doesn't stop. And my ultimate point is, once you cede the right and say they have the right to do this, I don't know how you ever stop it. And that's why I think an unbreached integrity is important. If you hold the line and say, listen, I am not going to compromise, I do not care. These are the principles I live by, these are the principles that are right for the state, I think that you can move mountains with that kind of integrity.
All right, let me give an argument that supports what you're suggesting, and that is that we can look at our system of government where the founders felt strongly propelled by what they had learned from history, not just England, but their study of political philosophy and governments around the world. They had learned that the most dangerous threat there was to the rights of man was the governments of man. And they wanted to do an experiment where they could create a government that wouldn't ruin the lives of its people, that wouldn't lie and cheat and rob the people blind. And that's what they set out to do with the American system. And we now have a system that is functioning in a way that's diametrically opposed to what the founders set up for us. And this supports your idea that by creating cracks in the wall through which the plunderers could slither through, that over time they reach a point where suddenly we're back with King George. England is now King George.
Yeah, and now I'm going to tell you an actual fact about Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson said that the natural course of things is for government to increase and liberty to decrease. And I don't think it's a stretch to assume that he knew that small compromises ultimately lead to the loss of liberty. You basically sell it piecemeal, bit by bit, until you don't have any, and no one even seems to realize what's happening. Now, on the state level, I mean, this point about integrity, one time I was talking to a Quaker lady who was a volunteer in prison, and I told her, you know, that I thought it was amazing that I have never been beaten up in prison because I'm a small person with a big mouth. You know, I speak my mind, in other words. And what she said to me has always stuck with me. She said that people respect integrity even if they don't know that they respect integrity. And that's why they don't beat you up, Michael, you know, basically is what she said to me, because they respected me. And I think that people will respect a candidate. If we had a candidate for governor that had an unbreached integrity, refused to compromise, and made the principled case strongly and clearly for liberty, I believe that that candidate can win. I think that that candidate can win the governorship. Unfortunately,
you have 1 minute left.
I have to call you right back.
Well, finish that thought.
Okay, what I was going to say is, unfortunately, I don't believe that Bob Stefanowski, the last Republican candidate, is that kind of candidate. And I base that on two interviews that he did with you recently, and I'll tell you all about it when I call you right back.
All right. Michael is in prison. A part of prison is a 15-minute limit per phone call, so he's going to hang up and reconnect with us, and we'll have another 15.
The caller has hung up.
All right, so continue with that point. Stefanowski was on here last week, and he was covering up and trying to protect Len Fasano, and Fasano is the great betrayer of conservative values in the state of Connecticut. So I think that's why you're mentioning this, right?
Well, Well, that's one of the interviews. In that interview, and let me just say at the outset that Bob Stefanowski seems like a nice enough guy, and he fought for, you know, to oppose tolls, and I don't want to take away from that. However, in the last interview he did with you, I think he may have torpedoed any chance that he has of ever being governor, because when you brought to your audience's awareness the fact that it was reported that Len Pisano had said that he would consider some tolls, not 50 gantries, but some. And Bob Stefanowski's first impulse was to defend Len Pisano. He said, well, you know, you have to agree to read the bill. And then he said, well, you know, you can't believe the media. And he said, I haven't talked to Len, so I don't know. Well, the problem is that most of us don't have the option of talking to Len. We get our information from the media, from the newspapers, from your show. And if Len Pisano doesn't come out and clarify or deny the reports or say he's unequivocally opposed to tolls, what else are we supposed to think? And I just think that at the very least, instead of defending Len Pisano, Mr. Stefanowski should have said, Len needs to come on this show or go on the news and clearly state that he's opposed to tolls. But he didn't do that. Instead, he seemed like he was equivocating, and it seemed to me that he may, although he didn't say this, he may equivocate himself if he were governor. He's willing to read the bill. I don't see what the point of reading a bill is if I know there's tolls in it and I know I'm not going to sign it. That's my personal opinion.
Yes, I think your point is wonderful. I didn't go after Stefanowski for doing this on Friday because I was so shocked by what he was doing and that he was directly confronting me as I attacked Len Pisano for being the compromising creature on what's best for the people that Pisano is. And I didn't know why Steph would be doing this, especially on tolls, where Bob's been out front on the issue since the election, or, you know, during the campaign, even longer than since the election. And
I understood it. It didn't surprise me at all.
Explain.
Well, I had previously told you about an interview that you had done with him. And I don't think that you saw the significance in the way that I saw it, and I hope that you do now. In that interview, Stefanowski was touting supply-side economics, or, you know, what's known as trickle-down economics, the Laffer curve. And in that interview, he was talking about tax cuts. And he said that the goal is to find the marginal rate that's going to maximize revenue. Now, in my mind, the purpose of government is to maximize liberty, not to maximize revenue to the state. And the implication of his statement was that if taxes need to be raised in order to increase revenue, then that's what you do. You cut taxes if that's going to do it. And the problem with that is it's a pragmatic point of view, not a principled point of view. It tells me that he's willing to compromise on principles of fundamental liberty. So it doesn't surprise me that he would stick up for Pisano, or that he may, and again, he didn't say he would, compromise on tolls. And that kind of goes back to the original point about compromise, is once you agree to a compromise, there's no end in sight. And unfortunately, I think that's the type of governor that he would be. And it doesn't make him a bad guy. I do think it would make him a bad governor.
So explain what you would do if there are people in the government who are making a legitimate argument that taxes need to go up. Wouldn't that require that
there
you find
no
a way to...
There is no legitimate argument that taxes need to go up.
What's that?
There is no legitimate argument that taxes need to go up.
Ever?
Never.
Taxes never need to go up?
No.
Even if you were at zero?
Even if you were at zero, I would argue for a system of voluntary taxation. Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying you go to that right now. You couldn't. The system.
No, that's a separate issue. We're talking principle here.
Yes. So
is there ever a time when government should increase revenue, or it should always be at zero? Is that your argument?
We should never increase it. If we were at the beginning, I would say leave it at zero. Where we are now, I would say don't go up, only go down. Cut spending and do it as fast and furious as you can while causing the least amount of harm.
But how would you operate a government if it had no money to operate?
Well, I disagree with the premise, but you've switched the argument here from a moral argument to a consequentialist argument.
Well, I'm just
okay.
Trying to understand.
But
so
I'm
what you're saying is
it.
There should be no government? Because government
what
requires...
What I'm saying is that I disagree with the idea that if people aren't forced to pay taxes, that the government wouldn't get funded.
Well, it could be a system of voluntary taxation. The government could still need money and still make an argument to the people.
Well, in that case, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about forced taxation. in that situation, if people are given the right to choose to it, then a legitimate increase in taxation might result if there was the need for police force to protect the rights of businesses in a given area that was plagued by crime.
Well, what if we had the system now where everything was the same, but there was a requirement of a referendum question being put to the people like they have in Colorado anytime the state of Connecticut wants to raise taxes? That would be your system, right?
Somewhat, but I would say that you still have to specify the purpose of government. And I actually, I think that any time you have a candidate for a political office on your show, you should ask them what they believe the purpose of government is. Because I believe the purpose of government is solely to protect the rights of the citizens. So therefore, if a tax increase on a voluntary system were proposed, I would support it if it was necessary to protect the rights of the citizens. If it wasn't necessary for that purpose, if it was for insurance, or medical care, or schools, or some such thing as that, I would not support it at all.
Okay, so government's only job is to protect our rights, not to deliver any services. If we want services delivered, who does that?
It would be handled by the free market. And again, that's why we need a candidate for office that can clearly and convincingly make the case for free market capitalism and for liberty in general. Ultimately for individual rights.
We're talking to Michael Leibowitz, as we do every week here on After Six. Okay, so if government doesn't provide any services, that means that the sewer systems, the water pipes, the roads, everything would be done by the private sector in your book?
Yes.
Do you see any service where it could be problematic to leave it to the private sector?
I see where it could be problematic, but I know from experience that all those situations are problematic when the government does it. And
well,
I think that in every case we know of, the private sector does better than what the government does. So I see no reason why it wouldn't be the case in those instances as well.
That's a pretty compelling argument, I think. And I'm glad you brought us there, because everything the government does, it seems to me, is it's bad at, especially when it has to do with its number one most important purpose, and that is protecting our rights.
Yeah, I'm with you 100% on that, Todd.
So the government's gotten poor at protecting our rights, but excellent at going out and subverting the notion of limited government, which is the propelling argument for the American system of government. Is that a fair way to look at it?
I think so, if I'm catching your meaning right, that you're basically saying that the government has gone opposed to what it's supposed to be doing and now is the rights violator instead of the rights protector. Am I hearing you correctly?
Yes, but it's the rights violator in the fundamental purposes, that is protecting our rights, though that are referred to as our God-given rights, that are the essential premise of a free society. That is, humans are meant to be free. Humans are meant to possess the fruits of their own labor. Humans are meant to plot their own course in life, and that whatever government there is should be absolutely at a minimum so as to allow us to do all those things that we are meant to do, and that's what you're arguing for in this discussion.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't matter whether it's those basic rights of us doing what we want or where we've hired the government essentially to provide services. In both areas, they've turned into the plundering class, and they run around with con stories, hustle stories all the time, trying to trick us into giving them more.
Yeah, and it ends up with them just selling favors anyway. So you end up with pressure group warfare, what Ayn Rand called the aristocracy of pull.
Yeah, well, there you go. All right, Michael Leibowitz, it's always fascinating to talk with you. Thank you for being here today. Thank you to your prison for allowing you to be here today. Thank you to you for sharing the ambiance of prison with us, because the irony of having this conversation about liberty with somebody who spent 22 years behind bars should never, ever leave our minds. It's just wonderful and powerful. So thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Can I leave you with a quote from Patrick Henry?
Yes, sir.
Is life so dear and peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
Ah, nobody ever says any more than those last few words. Thank you for sharing it. All right, Leibowitz, we'll talk to you next week.
All All right.
That's it for today's After Six. I'm Todd Feinberg. See you again tomorrow at 3. Stay tuned. We've got Clark Howard coming up after news on WTIC News Talk 1080.